Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Radical Compliance podcast. I'm Matt Kelly, editor of Radical Compliance, and today we are going to talk about the intersection of supply chain and environmental compliance. Specifically, we're going to discuss a new standard known as IPC 1754 that is meant to help aerospace and defense contractors to disclose any hazardous materials that might be used in their components. Now, the history here goes back to 2012. That is when the International Aerospace Environmental Group put together a working committee to harmonize all of the disclosures that companies need to make about hazardous material in their supply chain when they are bidding on government contracts and the like. The result is finally this new industry standard here that I mentioned is called IPC 1754. Now, this is both human and machine readable, and by machine readable, we mean that lots of these compliance obligations should become automatable by your technology as the computer programs get to read what materials are in these components. So joining us to talk about the new standard is Travis Miller of Ascent Compliance. Now, Ascent is a vendor that helps companies with supply chain compliance issues like hazardous materials, conflict minerals, and similar sort of challenges. So, Travis, welcome.
Thanks so much, Matt. Pleasure to be here, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
All right. So now, first question is just define the compliance burdens we are talking about, both, I guess, maybe the volume of disclosures that companies need to make. Is it a lot or a little? And the mechanics of how they're supposed to be making this disclosure. Is it fairly simple or is this an onerous process? What does all that look like so far?
Sure. So if you think about it, what the standard's really requesting and what's being driven is by a series of what I would classify as materials compliance regulations. Mm-hmm. So over the course of really the last decade, and this has been the origin of this whole area of law, this whole area of practice, a series of rules have been passed, starting really in Europe, transitioning over into the U.S., some other countries across Asia, and now quite heavily in Latin America, where in order to gain market access to sell a physical good on a certain location, you have to be able to look down into the chemistry of all the bits and pieces, the components that go into something, the materials, the resins inside of plastics, and decide if there's anything that could be classified as a high-risk substance, mm-hmm. either that has to be declared and told to your upstream customers or has to be restricted outright. Otherwise, you would lose complete access to the market for that given product. So if you think about something like an airplane or a heavy piece of industrial equipment, which is what the standard's designed to interact with,
yep.
that could be a burden of millions and millions of chemicals in vast sums and variations of concentrations. Everything from the button that goes on the seat and holds the seat cushion together, all the way up to the aluminum moldings and different types of chemicals and sprays and adhesives that make the airplane fly a little better.
So then how does the IPC standard 1754, how does that standard try to alleviate the burden here?
Sure. So the 1754 is the latest iteration in a family of standards. They're called the IPC 175X family. Mm-hmm. So what was designed here is an infrastructure that could grow and flex depending on different industry sectors' needs. And way back in the day, back when I had more hair and the compliance was much younger, they created a standard called the IPC 1752, which was designed to get a very detailed, granular look at something as small as a electronic piece or a component. And the overarching goal was to create a declaration that could have full material content or every single substance contained in a resistor or an integrated circuit or a very small thing.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense because then you can review that against the changing lists and keep up. Where that standard started to fall off and where a lot of the larger scale equipment manufacturers, cars and airplanes and industrial equipment kind of had trouble is that they were never going to get full material content declaration for a lot of stuff. If you think about it, a sheet of metal, you could have two different sheets, a series of bolts, a couple of different plastics, It could come from a few different vendors. And all of a sudden, the practical reality is you're never going to have the exact chemical concentration of an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So the 1754 really started to simplify things, is that it created a standardized list called the Aerospace and Defense Declarable Substance List, or the DSL, which was a list of all the substances all around the world that the aerospace and defense industry had to be worried about. They both go inside the airplane or inside the heavy industrial equipment, as well as that are used to process or to make that particular product function the way that it's supposed to. So whether that's a coating or some other element like that. And that became a real nuance or a shift fundamentally into the way people are going to make declarations.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about knowing what's in the product. It's knowing what's not in the product. And it's just knowing about the full chemical composition of the bit. It's also knowing that anything that ever treated that chemical or that treated that particular product for the purposes of knowing that if that substance becomes restricted or it's no longer usable or no longer is really on the market anymore because it gets banned, like an asbestos. You know, you can't really find asbestos anymore.
Yeah.
Then at that point, now what happens is it's not available for when that processing has to happen. So even though there might not be any left that goes on the airplane, you still need to know that it was used so that you can continue to service that airplane into its 50-year life cycle or whatever it might be.
So could you tell us a little more about the machine-readable part of this? Because I know a lot of compliance officers, even outside of heavy industry and away from hazardous materials, like the idea of being able to sort of let different IT systems read the documentation back and forth and kind of reduce the human involvement, everybody likes that idea. How does that surface in this standard here?
Sure. So you could think, I think there's maybe 100,000 suppliers on a given, large scale airliner or jet. So in order to aggregate all that information and somehow, tie it to what could loosely be described as a bill of materials, which has, a wing infrastructure and an engine infrastructure and a landing gear infrastructure. They're all different components that are put together to make this massive item, this massive thing. You need to have a lot of database and big data capability to kind of ingest it all and somehow tie it together to say, hey, this airplane has none of this. Or if it does have some, here's where it is. Here's where your substance of concern happens to be. So in order to do that, you have to make a couple choices. For an engineer, it's hard to think about something that is just purely electronic, a series of strings of code and text. It's really nice to have a visual to say, okay, well, my piece part, my little widget, this is what it's made up of, and here's what it looks like. That's something I can populate. So right there, for each individual, you need a interface, or you need what's called a creator, or something where you can enter in data and it spits out the other end a form. And now that form has to be able to be passed to somebody else so that they can use it. So what's happened with the IPC 175X family of standards is they've navigated towards this thing called an XML schema.
Sure.
So an XML schema is basically a bunch of computer code. It's gobbledygook to us if we were to look at it. But to a computer, once you pop it in to something that's made to ingest that schema, it knows that when this parenthetical opens, the next thing is going to be a substance. And then when this parenthetical closes and this next code happens, that's going to be your next part that's contained in this overarching assembly or this more complex thing. So now I can take that information and that coding, and it can match it against all those different components and parts that make up a very large thing. And your end result now is you can have a full ingested bill of materials with basically a digital or an electronic representation of a physical or tangible item.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the standard's kind of creating, almost like a trail or a linkage that something in the real world is represented by something in the digital world. and that can follow along with it as a chain of custody and to show that it's safe and doesn't have any of the hazard properties for compliance purposes.
So let me help me understand how the standard could be sort of inserted into companies and their compliance programs already in motion. They've got business processes. People might not want to upend that apple cart. Like, how can they kind of take this standard and run with it, with what they've already built up all around them over the years?
So to start, remember this whole rule set's pretty young.
Yeah.
10 years or so. So there's a lot of folks that really haven't built a proper program yet, and they don't know the exact chemical composition of, say, a nut or a screw or electronic bits and pieces. Some do, and they're quite far along. You know, they come into industries that got hit a little earlier, or they were under increased scrutiny. But a large number also don't. You know, machining shops and folks like that just haven't really encountered this that much. So they need to do the initial analysis, and they can either take that upon themselves to go back and either figure out the chemical composition or the product ecology, so to speak, of the entire item, or they can ask their next tier supplier, and they ask their next tier supplier, and so on, and you kind of get a dominoes phenomenon. You knock it in, it hits the next one, and so on and so on, and pretty soon you get a cascade effect.
Yeah.
And all that information is intended to kind of flow back up and funnel until it gets to that last person that has the largest supplier base of everybody. They're kind of the top of the stick, so to speak, and then it all gets aggregated. So what these forms do is they allow you to produce your piece to that overarching kind of tapestry. And once you produce it, because it's a standardized form, you should be able to give that standard to everybody rather than having to answer party A's request, which could be wildly different than party B, which could be wildly different than party C. And then everybody's asking you the same information just in different ways. And you can say, no, guys, I'm going to use my IPC 1754 that's been adopted by industry, and I'm going to give all you the same one. And I'm only going to have to do this once.
But now it's not going to get hung up on somebody saying, oh, geez, I'm on Oracle and the next guy's working on SAP and we've got a disconnect. I mean, will they be able to kind of cut across the system noise like that?
So I'd say, that's actually one of the hallmark issues that earlier iterations or attempts at standardization ran into in other industry sectors. As I mentioned earlier, there was the original 1752A, and that was exactly one of the problems. A computer-coded system is nothing different than really kind of almost an artist's rendering of what it is that code should look like, when something should open, when it should close, what data points should be aggregated, and where they should appear. So as you had different artists, so to speak, interpreting those forms and putting them into their own readers, into their own ingestion tools, it became very apparent that you really had to have that background and had to be very precise in the way that the standard was written. Mm-hmm. So the 1754, being almost a third or fourth generation, really, of these standards, has refined a lot of those elements out. And, to its heart, when you go back and you start doing due diligence and trying to find somebody that can help you out, having somebody that is qualified or has the background and like the 1752A and then is also moving into this new standard, it is incredibly important, because it teaches you that, they've already gone through and experienced some of the knocks and some of the hard elements to trying to get that written properly. In addition to which, they've probably figured out the mechanisms and the ways that you can take that data and you can exchange it with other databases and other systems and essentially play well with others versus just trying to code something for the first time or having your own tool built up where you're going to run into a lot of those challenges and get your form or your outbound kind of kicked back saying it has this gap here or it doesn't align with my system's needs here. Mm-hmm. And then, if you're just looking rawly at an XML schema, trying to figure out where that deficiency is, against the overarching, just code base with tons and tons of text strings here and there, it's pretty darn challenging, to say the least.
All right. Well, Travis, that's all the time we have today, but you covered plenty of ground for us, and thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure, man. Love talking to you, my friend.
All right. And again, everybody, that was Travis Miller of Ascent Compliance. He was talking with us about hazardous materials declarations and the forthcoming new IPC 1754 standard to simplify that effort. I should add, Ascent Compliance is having a symposium in Chicago on May 24th about the IPC 1754 standard. You can look that up. I will have a link to that in the show notes I have with this podcast. But that is all for this podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Matt Kelly, editor of Radical Compliance, and I hope you'll join me again next time.